Sudan's warring generals invited to peace talks after fighting kills at least 530 people since mid-April. More than 100,000 have fled their homes. How likely is a new peace initiative to succeed? This is Inside Story. Hello and welcome to the programme. I'm Imran Khan. Just over 2 weeks of fighting have plunged Sudan into a humanitarian crisis. Hundreds of people have been killed and thousands injured. Many more have been forced from their homes. The conflict is a power struggle between two one-time allies, the head of the army, General Abdel Fattah al-Burhan, and the leader of the paramilitary rapid support forces, Mohamed Hamdan Dagalo. South Sudan has brokered the latest truce, inviting both sides to talk while they lay down their weapons for a week. We'll be discussing the prospects of this initiative with our guests, but first, this report from Alex Beard.
Fleeing in the back of an overcrowded truck, Sudanese families make the long and difficult journey to safety across the border into Egypt.
We left Khartoum on Wednesday. It was very difficult. There were 28 of us. The boys don't have visas, but we kept them with us. Our suffering is unprecedented. We left in the middle of the fighting, clashes and even artillery. It was very upsetting.
This is the human cost of the conflict. The United Nations says at least 100,000 people have left for neighbouring countries, a number it's warned could rise above 800,000.
People coming from Khartoum who are escaping the war and trying to find safety and security arrive here under very difficult circumstances. Some people who have passed through here don't have food. Some are sick and some are very old.
For more than 3 weeks, the army and the paramilitary rapid support forces have battled for control of Sudan, with both sides violating ceasefire after ceasefire. Countries in the region are hoping this latest truce, brokered by South Sudan and due to last 7 days, will hold. The UN has said if Army Chief Abdel Fattah al-Burhan and RSF leader Mohamed Hamdan Dagalo refuse to negotiate, they risk international isolation. Aid agencies are scrambling to help, but say there is a shortage of funding and supplies.
The Secretary General dispatched Martin Griffiths, the emergency relief coordinator, to the region to explore how we can bring immediate relief to millions of people whose lives have been turned upside down. The UN and our partners are doing our best to reboot the humanitarian response in the country, Mr. Griffiths said. And as you'll recall, massive looting have displaced most of our supplies. We're urgently exploring ways to bring in and distribute additional supplies.
The Sudanese Health Ministry estimates hundreds of people have been killed and thousands injured. And only 16% of Khartoum's medical centres are still operating. People are running out of food and water, there are frequent power cuts, and more families are making the tough decision to leave their homes behind, in search of safety across the border. The UN is warning that if proposed peace talks don't resolve the conflict, the humanitarian crisis in Sudan could spill over and spread across the region. Alex Beard, Inside Story.
For more on this, I'm joined by our guest. In Nairobi is Niagoa Tutpour, South Sudan researcher at Human Rights Watch. She's a former paralegal for South Sudan's Ministry of Justice and Constitutional Affairs. In New York, Bakri Eljak Elmedni, a professor of public policy at Long Island University, Brooklyn. He co-founded Front Against War, a publication on Sudanese politics. And also in Nairobi is Stella Agara, Africa governance analyst who focuses on development security in East Africa. A warm welcome to you all. I'd like to begin in New York with Bakri. We have an extension to the ceasefire. It hasn't held for the last 6 days, but there's a potential for both parties to get around the table and talk over the next 7 days. There is this kind of optimism, but just talk us through what the issues are, the underlying issues are between the two sides.
Good afternoon, and thank you for hosting me. Let me start by, pass my warm condolences to the fallen and, wishes for speedy recovery for those who injured. I think the issues are deep. Some of them are structural. Let's just go back and say in 2017, when al-Bashir decided to completely become a very personalized dictator, he broke away from his own Islamist party and NCP, the National Congress Party, and he allowed the rebel support forces to become a quasi-independent army within the state. Those things really created a lot of disagreements and protest from the high leader, the generals of the Sudanese army. Even some of them would have to be asked to resign because they protested allowing an army or militia to be part of the state, but not really following any of the procedures. So that's a deep structural issue that you could point to going back to 2017 when al-Bashir decided to create a law to allow rebel support forces to be an independent standing army that is not part of the Sudan's armed forces. That's the beginning of the issue. Recently, we know that rebel support forces and General Degalo, as a leader of unique leader of this militia, he's deeply invested in gold and he's doing a lot of trades. They estimate that his net worth at this point is somewhere between $6 to $7 billion. So we know in order for Degalo business to continue to flourish, he needs power, he needs to be protected, and he has been using the state as a facade to get access to these resources. We also know Sudanese armed forces are deeply invested in a lot of economic activities. They are estimates that about 82% of Sudanese public sector is controlled by the Sudan Armed Forces investments. So we can see there are some competing over interests, there is competition over power. And the last straw that really broke the camel back was the conversation that took place in December. There has been a framework agreement developed after a long conversation, and regardless of how people think of the framework, but it brought the issues of control to the front. Some of the discussion has been about how do we go about creating a one army with one leadership and who has the right to be in charge. RSF and General Degalo asked to be allowed to have 10 years for his militia or rebel support forces to be functioning as an independent under his sole control.
Right.
And Sudanese army refused, rejected that proposal. And they were saying it has to be 2 years and it has to be under one leadership. And that means
That's a very interesting point. Bakri, that's a very interesting point. I want to bring in Nia Goa here, who is joining us from Nairobi. South Sudan's been a very key player here. It's got everybody around the table, or at least potentially around the table. But does it have any sway? Does it have any influence on these two very powerful and very entrenched and very independent organizations?
Thank you for including me in the conversation. I think it's been very clear over the last many weeks that South Sudan and Sudan are joined at the hip socially, politically, and also economically. Now, the fact that South Sudan was appointed as IGAD mediator is a reflection of this relationship. Since the crisis broke out in mid-April, over 30,000 people, some of whom are returnees, South Sudanese going back to South Sudan, and other nationalities, including Sudanese, have entered the South Sudan border. So South Sudan gets to play an essential role. Now, with regard to influence, like I've said, the two countries have social, political, and economic ties. The South Sudanese government, since the fall of the Bashir government, has also gotten very close with the Sudanese military government in Khartoum. And this is what is reflected in the appointment of President Kiir as mediator. Now, South Sudan has a role to play individually and also as part of the African Union, as part of the regional bloc of the Intergovernmental Organization on Development, and as part of the international body, whether as part of the Security Council, but as a member of the international community. It will be important for South Sudan to stress on the war on the two warring sides, to emphasize on civilian protection, to ensure that they end the use of weapons such as mortars, artillery shells, and mini rockets that are that have wide radius and are too inaccurate and are being used in civilian neighborhoods. They'll have to emphasize on the Sudanese leaders as well as all the other countries that are involved in mediate in conversations around this crisis, whether individually to Burhan or Hemeti or to other countries, the need for ensuring safe access for civilians, to allow civilians to evacuate buildings, to access medical attention, and to also, even as a country, South Sudan, to ramp up its own humanitarian support to prepare on how they will receive this vast numbers of people who are entering a country that has had a very huge humanitarian crisis in the last many years.
Well, let me bring in Stella Agara here, who also joins us from Nairobi. We've been hearing a lot about this internal government dialogue group. We've also been hearing a lot about the African Union. Do you think that those two organisations, those two, are the real players here? Or is it going to be something like the United Nations or an even broader international coalition to actually kind of bring peace to Sudan?
Thank you very much for having me in this conversation. Indeed, I think those two actors who have been brought in are some of the key actors in the conversation, of course, led by South Sudan. The previous speaker spoke about the strategic position of South Sudan, but also the fact that South Sudan depends on Sudan for oil refining and a bit of some of their trade. So they are squarely placed to be able to have the interest of ending the conflict and also the interest of driving Sudan towards some form of a resolution. The Africa Union, initially as the OAU, had a non-interference policy, but now as the Africa Union, it has a policy to interfere in nations anytime when there's need to secure the interests of citizens, to secure the lives of individuals in the continent. And so they play a very huge role. The AU Commission actually has, and the AU itself has a Department on Peace and Security that works around the issues of conflict around the region. And so they are squarely placed in that conversation to guide the conversation. And in the event that there's a need to send peacekeeping missions from around the continent, they will then be the ones coordinating the peacekeeping missions coming from the different countries neighboring Sudan. IGAD has a very critical role because it plays the role of promoting regional coordination and integration amongst the countries that are its members. Sudan is one of the members. The neighboring countries of Sudan who are now receiving refugees and the displaced people from Sudan are at the center of this conversation. So IGAD comes in critically to influence the conversation in terms of trying to bring the interests of the region together, ensuring that the member countries are on the table, even when the conversations are being held about the kind of humanitarian services the country needs, the kind of support that citizens in the event of the overflow. So these three actors that have been brought on the table truly deserve to be on the table. There are other actors who've been brought in through the expanded mechanism that has been created. And I've seen members of Russia, the United Kingdom, America, China, etc. And of course, they are coming in based on other interests. But it is important to keep this conversation very deeply African to ensure that then the issues are addressed here first before any other external interests are brought into play.
Well, let's bring in Bakri from New York. You've heard our guest in Nairobi actually say that, you know, this has to be an African thing and perhaps the African Union is the strongest, particularly if it can offer a peacekeeping mission. Are you confident that the African Union can play that role, or do you think it does need to have a wider international role? The UK, Russia, China, America, the United Arab Emirates, for example?
It's actually, I think the idea of allowing and importing AU to be part of solutions in Africa, I mean, going with the model African Programs, African Solutions is a noble and wonderful idea. I have to be frank and say I'm very skeptical about the possibilities of AU or IGAD actually being able to play any mediation role. I do understand IGAD countries have a stake in the game. These countries are going to be affected, and they are affected right now We're expecting about more than 200,000 of Sudanese refugees in the north. They will be going south. That's going to be an added crisis. Ethiopia has more than 300 refugees living in Sudan. They might be going back. So we do understand IGAD countries do have a stake on the game. We do understand AU has been trying to really play like a major role in addressing some African issues. But let's just go back to the basics. What leverage do the African Union really has on those two like warring parties? If you really think about it, it will come down to what influence do they have. The goodwill is fine. Having people talking about we want the war to stop is fine. Everybody has been calling for the war to stop. But let's just be honest. AU has no leverage over these warring parties. AU has no capacity. It has no mechanisms of maintaining peace. It's nothing more than just a goodwill hunting, in my opinion. So, yes, it's something to be appreciated. It's something to be we have to always welcome those ideas coming from African brothers to try to address African issues. But the issue lies among the four, the Troika. It's the U.S., U.K., Saudi Arabia, and Emirates, simply because they have been in touch with those two parties and they have influence over them. We all know Dagalo is funded and supported by
UAE. I'm going to disturb you there. I'm just going to disturb you there because I want to bring in Niyagar Tutpur. Bakri says that the African Union and the IGAD are their noble ideas, but they're just not going to work, and this needs to be a much broader international coalition to put pressure on the two warring parties. Do you think the African Union is a noble but flawed idea?
Look, I will take a leaf from the South Sudan peace process over the last many years. It takes a village to achieve, because the main goal here is to ensure civilian protection and at the end of the day, accountability for all the abuses being committed currently and over the last few years of the transition. So the whole international community does have the responsibility to ensure that the Sudanese crisis does not spiral out of control to the point that it also spills over to regional states such as South Sudan, Ethiopia, Chad, elsewhere. But also each country individually and as part of the collective has specific roles to be played. And so that's why I keep emphasizing that even if South Sudan may not have as much leverage as the U.S., they might be able to influence the two parties, especially in ensuring that, you know, civilian protection is a priority and that even the calls of the resistance committees and the various protest movements take center stage where we know that peace processes can often be elitist. It will take a village, it will take several efforts. It will be a costly process financially, politically, and also socially to the Sudanese and their neighbors as well. So it will take everybody to be able to use whatever access and leverage they have to ensure that security provisions, civilian protection, accountability, and justice are at the center of how the international community chooses to address this crisis and that they do not fail the Sudanese people. Again, because what we're looking at is the failure of the international community to deliver on the promises of the revolution that was delivered by the Sudanese people.
Stella, you've heard two very different opinions there. One very diplomatic opinion from Nairobi. Another, perhaps stronger opinion on the African Union from our guest in New York. Do you still think that the African Union, IGAD, these are the two best mechanisms after hearing those two opinions?
I think, first of all, I need to point out that it is very unfair to say that the African Union does not have capacity to intervene in this conflict. In the places in the continent where the African Union has not intervened, it is because they probably did not take interest in the conflict, but not because they didn't have capacity. As a matter of fact, they have a mandate, they have capacity, they have the ability to intervene. They have intervened in conflicts before, some election-related, others that are related to other factors, including cross-border conflict, and they continue to do so until today. IGAD has also played quite some role in some of the negotiations in the continent in dealing with conflict, and so they are centrally placed. For me, one of the questions I'm asking myself is, what do we define as leverage in this conversation? Leverage is ability to be able to understand the terrain around Sudan, leverages the ability to understand the geopolitics around Sudan, leverages the ability to have access into Sudan without being treated as an opponent. And for me, the fourth and most critical factor in this conversation, which is what I want to remind all of us, is that leverage is the ability to be that person who's not seen to be a contender in this conflict. We already have information that there's some external influence in the conflict in Sudan, and we have to make sure, and it is extremely important for matters of peace and security, that even as this resolution is being discussed and negotiated, that the people who instigated the conflict or the people who are behind the conflict do not then get opportunities to continue to fuel the conflict some more by virtue of bringing in their interests into the conversation. We already have some serious hardline positions from both fighting parties. And so bringing in actors who are going to embolden or even strengthen some of their hardline positions is not going to help this conversation. There's also the dynamic of actually being around their neighbors who all have interest and therefore are deeply interested in seeing peace in South Sudan. In terms of the question of who is going to be able to negotiate in the place of South Sudan against international interests, I think African countries and the AU itself is even also well positioned to that extent. They may not necessarily be having the most leverage as far as resources are concerned, but at least in terms of finding a solution, I think they're the best place to lead a negotiation process.
Bakri, what we're hearing is that there is the African Union, there is IGAD, these are the front line organisations that are going to deal with any kind of peace, but we have to talk about the region as well. Egypt probably has a very different idea about what it wants in Sudan to, say, Chad. For example, Chad has a different idea to the other neighbouring countries. There's a lot of competing interests here. Is there anything other than stopping the conflict that these people can agree on?
I tend to be one of those people who really think it's there is a way of addressing different neighboring countries' interests at the same time talking something sustainable, not just stopping the conflict. Because let's just be honest, stopping the conflict at this point in time is not going to address Chad or Wagner, the Russian, or as we speak, we know that there are trucks carrying over 10,000 loaded fuel. This is supplied from Haftar in Libya to RSF forces. This is a Guardian broke the story the other day, and there are evidence on the ground this is happening. So what I'm saying is, I don't think we can ignore what it concerns Egypt has raised. Egypt has been a very influential country in Sudan. They have a very strong ties with Sudanese military. And they are going to be one of the countries that really will influence what's going on in Sudan. And it's not just about Sudan and Egypt. Egypt has deep interest in the Nile. There are some standing issues regarding the Great Dam in Ethiopia, how the dam is going to be run. The wars in Ethiopia is connected to what I'm trying to say. What's happening in Sudan is not uniquely a Sudanese issue. It's a regional issue. And if we don't really find the way to thread the needle in how we address these different concerns and interests for the neighboring countries, Egypt, Ethiopia, South Sudan, Chad, Libya at the same time, we will be back on this issue at some point. If not in Sudan, it's going to be in Chad. If not in Chad, it's going to be in Central African Republic. They are really complicated, connected issues. Some of them competition over resources. Some of them is competition over influence. And I tend to, I'm not really positive if regional players alone can really spread and unravel this. This is
it's an interesting point. Let me bring in Nia Goa here from Nairobi. You've heard what Bakri had to say. It is very, very complicated. There's a lot of countries, a lot of different competing interests. However, you know, what Stella was saying is that perhaps one of the things that could happen is a peacekeeping mission, African Union peacekeeping mission in Sudan. But the danger of that is it's almost like a plaster. You don't actually deal with the underlying issues, the regional issues. You just send in a peacekeeping mission and that kind of freezes the conflict, but it doesn't really actually sort out the issues. Do you think that's a danger?
I think by all means, we have to avoid bandage solutions to a crisis that has very deep roots and where the underlying causes have not been addressed. Now, with the Juba peace process, the Sudanese Juba peace process, we all know that the security arrangements that were put in place, as well as aspects around civilian protection, were never rolled out and were thrown underneath the surface. And so as of now, and what we're seeing internationally as well, is lots of disjointed statements and multiple actions, left, right, and center. But really, there's no coordinated diplomatic effort on how to go about addressing the Sudanese crisis as a whole. So this is something that needs to be emphasized, and that public statements being made by multiple countries have to have there has to be a united front in how the Sudanese crisis will be addressed, because as Bakri says, the impacts extend beyond the borders of Sudan, and they will have regional impacts. For the South Sudanese example, you know, the humanitarian crisis is one thing, but also the impacts on markets that rely on Sudanese goods and will have an impact on food insecurity in South Sudan. So there will need to be high-level, credible, coordinated diplomatic efforts, and to really address the underlying causes and to bring civilians at the center, the resistance committees, the various movements that have been...
We are running out of time, and I do want to come back to one final question. Other guest in Nairobi, Stella. Stella, there are two very powerful individuals here, Abdul Burhan al-Fattah and Hamiti. These are people who aren't really going to speak to each other across a table unless they're going to sign something. Do you think you can deal that the international community, the regional community, the African Union can deal with those egos?
In all honesty, I am one of those who has already admitted that their egos are too big, and at some point they may need to be pushed to make certain decisions for the benefit of the citizens of Sudan. These big egos do not add any value into the conversation, and it's extremely important the interests are put on the table, and that those interests are then assessed or based on the merit of what can be delivered within a short-term period, what can be delivered within a long-term period. Whatever it is they're interested in must and will be delivered in the body of a nation that has a government, that has proper governance going on. Otherwise, they will continue with fighting and destroy everything in the country and not add value. So for me, in this conversation, what all the actors must convince these people to do is, number one, to get them on the table. Number two, assuming they will not speak to each other, at least to get their factions to begin putting considerations of what is possible within a short time and what is not possible within a short time. I think also an understanding of what they will be accountable for if this conflict continues as it is extremely important. And for me, if it means calling out the possibility of litigation after this whole process is completed is extremely critical, because then even if they're engaging in war, there are certain laws that govern how they engage in war. Right. We have the international humanitarian law, etc., that they have fully flaunted. And so it's extremely, extremely important that then they are brought on the table to understand this, to understand that women, youth, and children must be protected even as they engage in whatever conflict they want to engage in, and that they cannot plan to have a protracted when their neighbors depend on them for trade, for other factors, including routes that are used within that country to get things done in the region.
I want to thank all our guests, Niagoa Tutupur, Bakri Eljak Elmedni, and Stella Agara. And I want to thank you too for watching. Now, you can see the programme again anytime by visiting our website, aljazeera.com. And for further discussion, go to our Facebook page. That's facebook.com/AJInsideStory. And you can also join the conversation on Twitter. Our handle is @AJInsideStory. From me, Imran Khan, and the whole team here, bye for now.